Hi, everybody. This is Naturally with your headline news. Vice.com reports last year, researchers estimated there were 5 trillion pieces of plastic in the ocean, many of which are small enough to be ingested by ocean life and work their way through the food chain, ultimately arriving on your plate. Unsurprisingly, toxicologists say this is problematic and potentially harmful to human health. Research has shown that plastic acts like a sponge for other chemical contaminants in the water, and fish that ingest them are more likely to have liver problems and tumors. If you thought the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, a giant vortex of man-made debris that accumulate and swirl in the middle of the ocean, was frightening, the new report is far more troubling. Currently, at least 8 tons of plastic leak into the ocean every minute, which the report says is equivalent to dumping a garbage truck full of plastic straight into the sea. That will increase to 2 trucks per minute by 2030 and 4 per minute by 2050. Annual global plastic production, currently at 311 million tons, is set to explode worldwide, doubling in the next 20 years and arriving at 1.12 billion tons by mid-century. And though recycling can help prevent plastic ending up in the ocean, disposable plastic products are still a problem, regardless of whether or not they are broken down and reused. Currently, 6% of the world's oil use is devoted to producing plastics, the same amount used by the global aviation sector. That is expected to increase to 20% by 2050. NewYorkTimes.com reports, the Obama administration last Friday proposed a new rule aimed at curbing emissions of planet-warming methane from oil and gas drilling on public land. It would force companies to use equipment to capture leaked gas and raise the costs they pay for extracting fuel on government property. It follows last week's controversial move by the Interior Department to halt new leases for coal mining on public lands and to reform the government's program for leasing federal lands to coal companies with an eye to raising their costs. It also comes as the administration has particularly targeted emissions of methane, a chemical contained in natural gas that is about 25 times more potent than carbon dioxide. The Obama administration wants to cut methane emissions from the oil and gas sector by 40% to 45% from 2012 levels by 2025. United States oil production is at its highest level in nearly 30 years, and the nation is now the largest producer of natural gas in the world. That boom in production has led to lower energy prices, but also to more natural gas and methane leaks. About 5% of the nation's oil supply and about 11% of its natural gas supply are extracted from about 100,000 federal onshore oil and gas wells. In 2014, those wells generated about $3 billion in royalties to the Treasury. From 2009 to 2014, enough natural gas was lost through venting, flaring, and leaks to power more than 5 million homes for a year, according to figures provided by the Interior Department. That led to a loss of up to $23 million annually in royalty revenue to the federal government, according to a 2010 report by the Government Accountability Office. TheGuardian.com reports, water authorities across the U.S. are systematically distorting water tests to downplay the amount of lead in samples, risking a dangerous spread of the toxic water crisis that has gripped Flint, documents seen by The Guardian show. The controversial approach to water testing is so widespread that it occurs in, quote, every major U.S. city east of the Mississippi, end quote, according to an anonymous source with extensive knowledge of the lead and copper regulations. Quote, by word of mouth, this has become the thing to do in the water industry. The logical conclusion is that millions of people's drinking water is potentially unsafe, end quote, he says. Documents seen by The Guardian show that the water boards in cities including Detroit and Philadelphia, as well as the state of Rhode Island, have distorted tests by using methods deemed misleading by the Environment Protection Agency. There is no suggestion that EPA regulations have been broken, but the agency's guidelines have been systematically ignored. Dr. Yana Lambrinido, a Virginia Tech academic, has disclosed what she considers to be evidence of deceptive practices by city water authorities after she sat on an EPA task force that reviewed federal rules on lead and copper poisoning that have been in place since 1991. The task force ended its work last year, shortly before the full extent of the city of Flint's problems with smelly brown water hit the headlines, with Lambrinido criticizing the final report for failing to step up protections to prevent the corrosion of pipes, which leads to lead leaching into water supplies. The documents were obtained by Lambrinido under freedom of information laws and direct requests to water authorities. They show that several cities have advised residents to use questionable methods when conducting official tests for lead content. These include encouraging testers to run taps for several minutes to flush out lead from the pipes or even removing the filter from taps. Such methods have been criticized by the EPA for not providing accurate results, with the agency telling authorities not to use them. And now, here's Mike with a special report.
Thank you very much, Natural E. We here at Eco Radio, we generally don't deal in controversy. We generally, our mission is to uplift those who are working to improve our environment and to educate our listeners on different environmental issues. But sometimes people have different perspectives. People who on both sides of an issue are still working for the environment. And so we were contacted a while back from a listener who brought to our attention an issue regarding the Kaw Valley Seed Fair. And I'm going to read a bit of a statement from that listener, and then not feeling comfortable just reading that statement, we did contact people at the Kaw Valley Seed Fair, and they provided a response, and we will read that as well. I will be taking the names out of both of these statements. So this was with regard to the Kaw Valley Seed Fair, which is coming up on February 13th. And so here's this an initial statement, and with the headline, "Locavores use not family-friendly to exclude vegan activists from a public event where meat vendors are welcomed." I have been a vendor at the Kaw Valley Seed Fair, a yearly event free and open to the public on the Douglas County Fairgrounds each February. More vendors want into this fair than there is room to accommodate, and I was told that once you are in as a vendor, you have first crack at a space the following year. But this year, when I attempted to rent a booth, I was told that I could not because of something that was alleged to have happened last year, but I was never informed of. My booth was giving away free gluten-free vegan food, recipes, packets of kale seeds, a newsletter that I publish, and information on the health, environmental sustainability, and social justice imperative of veganism. There were vendors at the fair selling meat who were not happy that I was there. When I asked one of the organizers why I was excluded, she said they had a complaint from another vendor who claimed to have overheard me say to a child and her mother that if they ate meat, they were murdering animals. Never mind that those don't sound to me like words I have said at such an event. I was never told about this, never given a chance to respond to this alleged misconduct or anything. I was never informed that they had rules making free speech a cause for dismissal either. The board decided, based upon this hearsay evidence, to not allow me to table. An other organizer, whom I subsequently contacted, had been more professional in her conversations with me, has said that it was unfortunate that I was not informed of the problem before this year's fair invitations went out, but the decision was final. She also emphasized that as a family-friendly event and my message and information was not welcoming. However, this perspective is not applied equally. The vegans who attend this event, which is, after all, about seeds from plants, find the presence of dead animal bodies and their stolen secretions very unwelcoming, but the meat, dairy, and egg vendors are allowed to table, sell products, and share their perspective that it's perfectly fine to kill animals for completely unnecessary reasons. So I forwarded that on to the organizers of the Kaw Valley event. This is me talking again. And I said, I asked for a response to the statement I just read. And then, in addition, I posed three other questions. Who runs the Kaw Valley Seed Fair? Is it a nonprofit organization? Is it a private organization? Who serves on the board? Also, what does the money from the vending fees go towards? And also, is there a policy which was violated which led to this exclusion? And in my conversation with the organizer from the seed fair, the word exclusion she felt was not accurate. It was just that she was not invited. Yeah, we'll take, So now here's the response. And this is broken up into sections, so I'll give you the headline. About the Kaw Valley Seed Fair. So this is from the organizers, the planning committee of the Kaw Valley Seed Fair. About the Kaw Valley Seed Fair. The Kaw Valley Seed Fair is held on the second Sunday in February this year, on February 13th, 2016. Did I say Sunday? I meant to say Saturday. On the second Saturday in February this year, on February 13th, 2016, at the Douglas County Fairgrounds in Building 21 from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. The fair is free and open to the public. The fair is a pre-spring celebration centered around a free, all-inclusive seed exchange. This year, we will have an expanded educational area, including at least 5 plant/seed propagation demonstrations that are held throughout the day. In addition, the Lawrence Community Nursery School will provide children's activities during the fair, including crafting and a sensory seed bin. Farmers market-style vendors will be tabling at the event, selling items produced from local farms, as well as garden centers selling seed starting materials and tables with information about local seed banks and libraries. Returning for a third year, a vegetarian hot food will be provided by a local catering company who uses sustainably grown vegetables with an emphasis on local produce and nutrient-dense varieties. Okay. About the planning committee, the Kaw Valley Seed Fair was founded in 2009. The current mission of the event is to provide an opportunity for people to trade, share, and learn about seed saving. The fair is governed by a planning committee comprised of private citizen farmers, producers, scientists, and educators. The fair is self-supporting through fees charged for vendor/exhibitor tables and donations. There are no entry fees charged to the fair, and all monies raised are set aside for the next year to rent the fairgrounds hall. The planning committee is not allied with any religion, political entity, organization, or institution. The committee does not engage in any controversy and neither endorses nor opposes any cause. Okay. Vendor exhibitor selection. Each year, the planning committee review a list of vendors/exhibitors from the previous year and requests from new applicants to create an invitation list. An email is sent to each organization in early January with instructions on how to apply for a table for the current year. Vendors, exhibitors who have previously tabled at the fair may not be invited to return for a variety of reasons, including A, they failed to pay the table fee, B, they violated the cancellation policy, or C, they were found to have engaged in unprofessional conduct. The selection of vendors/exhibitors is solely at the discretion of the planning committee. Next section, recent allegations from a former exhibitor. An exhibitor at the 2015 fair has alleged on her blog, in letters to newspapers, radio stations, and in her complaint filed with the Douglas County Sheriff's Office that she is being excluded from the fair because her message was not family-friendly and unwelcoming. In actuality, the vendor was informed by 2 planning committee members that she was not extended an invitation for 2016 because during the 2015 fair, she engaged in unprofessional behavior toward a fairgoer and her child. The volunteer committee takes these matters seriously, and the safety and positive experience of our fairgoers is of the utmost importance. The 2016 fair. We are excited about the great events we have planned for this year's fairgoers. We have expanded our educational opportunities in addition to the amazing exhibitors and vendors who are lined up this year. Our all-volunteer committee works hard to maintain a celebratory atmosphere, including positive messages of support for local food production and especially locally sourced open pollinated seeds. And so that's basically the event. There is a Facebook event page. I think that's the best way to contact folks if you want to find out more about that. Or you can post on our Eco Radio Facebook page and ask us to help facilitate that if you have any more interest. And before we turn it back over to Natural E, we're going to take our first break.
trying to make a living. Blues, Barbecue, and Brews, a musical evening benefiting All Souls Unitarian Church and KKFI. The performances by Danny Cox and Bob Walkenhorse and the Shawnee Mission East Jazz Band. Saturday, January 30th from 6 to 9 p.m., 4500 Walnut, Kansas City, Missouri. Doors at 5:30, music at 6, dinner served at 6:15. Donation of $25 includes all the music and all you can eat. For just $20, all the music you can hear. Advance tickets available at All Souls Unitarian Church, 10 to 2, Monday through Friday, or at 816-531-2131. Benefiting KKFI and All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church. That's Blues, Barbecue, and Brews on January 30th at 6 p.m. Come on out.
Preventing stormwater pollution in winter on this current cast. Salt, sand, chemical concoctions, and even fertilizers are used to melt ice and provide traction in wintry climates. But when the snow and ice melt, those same items which provide a safe environment wash into storm drains and local water supplies. The side effects of these common winter products include reducing oxygen levels in water, burning and killing vegetation, or increasing sediment buildup in the water, all of which can degrade aquatic habitats. So, to stay safe and reduce the amount of pollution going into the water this winter, try these tips. Shovel frequently during storms, use only one entrance to your home, and use just as much product as necessary, and no more. Support for CurrentCast comes from the Mitsubishi Corporation Foundation for the Americas. Learn more online at currentcast.org.
All right, everybody, we're back, and I'm here with my guest, Biagio Pagano. Would you please introduce yourself?
Hi, Aaron. Thank you for having me back again. And Mr. Murphy, thank you. As Aaron mentioned, my name is Biagio Pagano, and I teach health and environmental courses at Baker University, also at the Kansas City Art Institute. And my background is also as a practitioner working in the field of public health with the Kansas Department of Health and Environment, Eastside Health District in East St. Louis, Illinois, and here locally with the health department. So I have a good number of years of experience of working in chronic disease risk reduction, infectious disease control, and environmental analysis and education. So it's good to be back.
All right. Yes. Mm-hmm. We're glad to have you here again on our
Thank
show.
You.
So today we're going to talk about household hazardous products, right, Biagio?
Correct. Correct.
And what are there some other topics we're going to cover tonight?
Well, just kind of giving the audience a little bit of an overview here, not only a definition, but some of the inherent concepts associated with household hazardous products, the different categories, a little bit about the history of the program itself, examples of some of the toxic substances that we are exposed to, guidelines in purchasing also the products and using them safely. Examples of high-risk populations that are mostly affected by these chemicals. How do we dispose of them properly, store them properly? And certainly, what are some safer alternatives, non-toxic or less toxic alternatives? And where to get additional information when people are searching for this?
Okay. So let's start with the, will you just define it for us? What is a household hazardous product?
Definitely. A household hazardous product is a product whose use and disposal poses a threat not only to human health, but also to other living organisms and the environment as a whole. We should all be careful not to get rid of these leftover products that could be very damaging. In other words, a lot of people are pouring them down the drain, down the sink, in the toilet, abandoned wells, places like that, bodies of water in open fields. Some people even take the risk of burning them with their garbage. These are things that we highly certainly believe that it should not be done because of the various dangers. All that. And associated with that, these products are either like flammable or combustible, which means that they can catch on fire. They can be explosive or reactive, which means that when exposed to high levels of heat or pressure, that can be a danger. They could also be corrosive, which means that it can burn living tissue and materials, and certainly toxic, which means that it can cause injury or death through the three major routes of exposure, which is inhalation, certainly inhalation, skin absorption, and direct ingestion, usually accidentally. Populations that are mostly affected by this would be like the elderly, certainly children and infants. In fact, one of the major causes of childhood poisoning are due to these products that we use every day in our home. People with suppressed immune systems, people with chronic diseases like cancer and heart disease are more susceptible to these chemicals. So those are just some examples. And we can't forget our pets, too, because they can be certainly adversely affected by these particular things. There's another category that a lot of people don't think about, and I'm hoping that physicians become more aware of this, but there is a syndrome called multiple sensitivity syndrome, and about 15 to 20% of our population is very hyperactive, or I should say they react very in a very sensitive way to many of these chemicals and creating allergies or suppressing their immune system and things like that. So I'm hoping that more testing can be done, something like this, throughout physicians' offices and health departments and places like that.
Biagio, will you tell us the major categories and examples of household hazardous products?
Okay. There's five major categories that are associated with this topic, and one of them is automotive products. These are things like gasoline, motor oil, leftover antifreeze, windshield wiper fluid, car wax and cleaners, lead acid batteries that has not just sulfuric acid, but also obviously the lead, brake fluid and transmission fluid. A special note about antifreeze is that some people know this, but not everybody. Antifreeze actually has a sweet flavor to it, and it can be a real attractive thing to children, infants, because of the taste, and also to pets. Very deadly compound. So that's one of the major categories. The other one would be like home improvement products, paints, varnishes, stains, paint thinners, paint strippers, caulks, adhesives, compounds like that. A third category are your pesticides, okay, insecticides, insect repellents, even flea collars, things that we use to kill our rats and mice around the area. Mothballs, and even wood preservatives. In wood preservatives, we do add pesticides to them in order to keep various types of insects at bay.
Mothballs are toxic?
Yes, yes. And again, more the children are the ones who we need to be really careful about, so keeping things like this away from the hands of children. And there's other things that we can do to reduce our risk or exposure, and I'll be getting into some discussion about that in terms of non-toxic alternatives. Another one would be like your household cleaners. This is a very common one and a major childhood poisoning issue. Furniture polish, your drain openers, oven cleaners, things like that, your tub and tile cleaners, toilet bowl cleaners, spot removers, bleach, ammonia. Almost every household in America has one or more of these products. Be extremely careful, especially about mixing these types of compounds, especially when it comes to ammonia and bleach, because you have a chloramine gas that's produced when you mix that, and it's very, very toxic. There's also another final category. It's sort of like a catch-all kind of category called other. And these are like household batteries, cosmetics, pool chemicals, your shoe polish, lighter fluid, prescription medications, things like that, arts and crafts material. Prescription meds have been under the limelight for the last 10 years. And what we're finding out is that there are very, very small amounts that have been detected in our drinking water. Mm-hmm. And it's questionable whether our filtration systems and our water treatment plants are sophisticated enough to really eliminate all of that. So we need to be careful. And as our population grows and more people become ill and they're using more and more medications, that becomes a greater risk. Psychotropic medications, cardiac, antidepressants, anything like that. So a lot of people will just simply dump the excess down their toilet, and you know, that's what they do, and that's a risk.
There are drug take-backs throughout our communities. So if anyone has leftover prescription drugs, you can actually find them online where you can take those to have them safely disposed of so they don't go into our water supply. Mm-hmm.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you for mentioning that. There's always something that we can do to deal with these problems. I wanted to give you just some examples of chemical compounds that are found in our products that we use, like antifreeze, for example, ethylene glycol, very, very dangerous, associated with heart disease, brain and kidney damage. Motor oil, my goodness, when I went through the training on working with these proper disposal methods and educating the public and encouraging them to use our local facilities, they are high, obviously, in hydrocarbons, and some of these hydrocarbons are associated with cancer risk. And there's also heavy metals, which affects the kidney, the brain, liver. Car batteries, you have sulfuric acid. Paints and solvents have compounds that create severe headaches, irritation to the eyes and skin. Oven cleaners, potassium hydroxide, fatal if swallowed accidentally. Rug and carpet cleaners, naphthalene, associated with developing cataracts, cancer, liver damage, things like that. Even our batteries that we use on a day-to-day basis have acids in them that can be damaging. So we got quite a challenge. And the way that I became interested in this is this awareness came out back in the 1980s, but in the 1990s, there were some federal funds that were available to local communities to develop these disposal facilities for household hazardous products. Now, we're not talking about the major industries. We're talking about what people use on a day-to-day basis and improperly dispose of. So we applied for these funds. The community got behind it. We were able to get matching funds associated with that, and we developed ours, which is in Wyandotte County. But in the entire metro area, there is at least one of these facilities in each one of the counties, or that cover a multi-county area that people can certainly utilize. And I'll go ahead and give those numbers to everybody. In fact, just so I don't forget, may I give those numbers?
Absolutely.
Okay. In Kansas City, Missouri, the number that you can call, and again, these are household hazardous waste sites for households, not for industries, okay? And I always encourage that people call well in advance to find out what the hours and the time, dates, and all that, and also to make sure to let them know what you have, because they may not accept everything that you think would be acceptable. So in Kansas City, Missouri, it's area code 816-784-2080. In Lee Summit, 816-969-1805. Overland Park, 913-715-6900. And in Wyandotte County, 913-573-8318. And please, everybody write down this number, too. It's the Poison Control Center, which covers both Missouri and Kansas. And that number is area code, it's 800-221-1220. 800-221-1220.
Piaggio, you want to say those numbers again?
Sure. Okay. In Kansas City, Missouri, 816-784-2080. Lee Summit, 816-969-1805. Overland Park, 913-715-6900. Wyandotte County, 913-573-8318. And poison control is 800-222-1222.
Thank you. Right.
You're welcome. If there is a suspicion of a child in your home or anybody that has ingested something that can be poisonous or dangerous to them, don't immediately, and I can't stress this enough, do not immediately induce vomiting. that's one of the first things that people think about doing is give them syrup of Ipecac and let them vomit and so we get that out of. That's not the case because some of these chemicals can be very caustic, and if a child is vomiting that out, it can cause even more damage to the esophageal lining. So the first thing you should do is immediately call the Poison Control Center and tell them over the phone exactly what has been ingested, and they will go ahead and give you the directions as to what precisely to do.
Biagio, we're going to take one break, and then we will be right back.
Okay, thank you.
On Tuesday at 6 p.m., Radioactive Magazine host Brian Noland is joined by community activist and professor Gene Morgan and local attorney DJ Pierre, recently appointed to the Mayor's Citizens Task Force on Violence, for a discussion on crime in Kansas City, its causes, and possible solutions. That's Radioactive Magazine, Tuesday at 6 p.m. right here on KKFI.
This is Bob Dole. 1996 was supposed to be the year of Bob Dole. It was Bob Dole's turn to be president. You know it, I know it, the American people know it. But that triangulating troublemaker from Arkansas got reelected. If you're like Bob Dole and don't want to relive 1996, don't tune in to your Wednesday morning buzz from 6 to 8 with Mike Murphy. Bob Dole approves this message.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Whenever people switch sides, it grabs our attention. Stephen Colbert to The Late Show, Johnny Damon to the Yankees, Darius Rucker to country music, and now Greg Fischel, chief meteorologist for WRAL in Raleigh, North Carolina. He was the first certified broadcast meteorologist in the U.S., but he did not believe humans played a role in climate change.
I was a hardcore skeptic for most of my adult and professional life.
But one morning, he woke up with a question.
Greg, are you doing the same thing that the people you're criticizing are doing and that you're only looking for information to support what you already think?
So Fischel sought evidence from a wide range of experts and came away with a new understanding.
Nobody is absolutely sure what the climate's going to be like in 50 or 100 years, just like I can't tell you exactly what the temperature's going to be like in Raleigh tomorrow afternoon at 3. Just because I don't know everything doesn't mean I don't know anything. We still know a lot, and we still know enough to realize that we're messing with something here that we probably shouldn't be messing with.
In preparation for a half-hour TV special, Fischel traveled the continent to interview experts. He hopes the program will help his viewers better understand climate change. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
Welcome back to Eco Radio. I just wanted to say also, if there's anyone out there who wants to call in and ask Biagio a question or make a statement, you can do so at 816-931-5534. That's 816-931-5534. Biagio, what are some guidelines to follow when purchasing these products, and how can we safely use these products?
Yes, absolutely. Good questions. When you're buying these products, try to, number one, find if there is a safe and a less toxic or non-toxic alternative, number one, to do the same job. The other thing, too, is look for signal words. On each one of these products, when they're set hazardous chemicals, there are signal words, which so they'll say like either poison or danger. If it says danger or poison, that means it's highly toxic. If it says something like warning or caution, that means that it's less toxic. So you can go with a less toxic alternative. Buy only what you need, okay? Because if you buy only what you need, you're going to use only what you have purchased to do the job. If there's a lot that's left over, that's when you have an improper disposal issue. If the label on the product says non-toxic, be careful with that because the term non-toxic is a little bit misleading because there can still be some hazardous ingredients in them, especially if you're going to use large amounts and if there's chronic exposure, that means you're going to be using the product for a long time, over a period of time. Read carefully the labels in the back. These are some key terms I want to share with the audience here, listening audience. Terms like vapor harmful, okay, causes burns to skin and eyes, if it says the term flammable. And I know that this sounds like common sense, but we don't always use common sense. I've been guilty of that myself, so again. Or avoid skin contact or keep away from children. Okay, and if it says use gloves or protective eyewear or something like that, again, be careful with that. Make sure that it has child-proof packaging. We always recommend it at the health department. Never purchase anything that comes in an aerosol because, number one, it can, if it's connected to any kind of a heat source, it can explode. When something becomes aerosolized, it goes directly into the lungs and then directly into the vascular or capillary tissue of the alveoli with the small sacs. And then from there on, it travels to every organ of the body. So, and especially pregnant women, that's another high-risk group I may not have mentioned. Important on that. Use the product safely. In other words, use as prescribed by the manufacturer. But again, always keep in mind, try to go with a non-toxic alternative. And I have a few examples here to share with you. So read everything carefully. Do not mix products together. Okay. And also, too, using twice as much doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to have twice the effect. And all you're doing is just creating more of a chemical compounds that kids can get exposed to, the environment, animals, and that kind of thing. Store properly away from children, not only out of their reach, but it's also a good idea to put a lock on the door. Kids have a way of moving around in the home. They can climb. They can still get access to this one. And at the moment that you're not looking, this can happen. Do not use anything that can vaporize when you have soft contact lens, because these chemicals, especially when they do volatilize, which means it can become airborne, can get caught behind the contact lens and actually can build up and cause some serious damage. This next point is very common sense also, but don't eat, drink, or smoke around hazardous products, and use in a well-ventilated area. Use protective gloves when necessary and clean everything up as soon as possible. Don't create any spills or anything like that. So those are some points to remember.
Some good guidelines. Thank you, Biagio.
Welcome.
What are some examples of foods with potentially hazardous chemicals?
Okay. Microwave popcorn. Oh, my goodness. Okay. Pyrofluorcetanic acid, or PFOAs, is a toxic substance. It's used when you're making Teflon, but it's also used in the heat component of microwave popcorn to make things warmer, this kind of thing. And it's been shown to cause cancer in laboratory animals. I would stay away from that. Just get regular popcorn, preferably organic, and a little bit of olive oil, and you're pretty well covered. Okay. Bisphenol A is also found in the linings of cans, okay, and especially in tomato cans. The bisphenol A is added so that the food does not adhere to the inside of the can, and so that is an issue. Bisphenol A has been known to be an endocrine disruptor. It can have problems with reproductive capabilities and things like that. It's also been linked to memory issues and depression, things like that. Processed meat, be very careful. I know that these are not considered to be household hazardous products, but in my discussions with you, Aaron, you thought it was perfectly acceptable to bring them into play. Sodium nitrate is used as a preservative, but also to make the meat seem redder. And its primary goal was to reduce the risk of botulism, okay, which is noble. But one of the things that the manufacturer is not being completely honest about is that when these compounds, like nitrates and nitrites, come into contact with sulfuric acid in your stomach, hydrochloric acid, is converted into cancer-causing substances referred to as nitrosamines. Potato chips, be careful with that. When you buy potato chips or French fries, whenever you're frying those kinds of carbohydrates, you have a chemical called acrylamine, that's generated as a result of that.
Because you fry the potato, it's naturally occurring in there, and frying it brings it out, or what?
The frying process actually makes the acrylamide, so it's a chemical process. And these compounds are inherent within potatoes, but when you bake it, it doesn't cause that problem.
Because you know I love French fries.
I understand. I hate to be a bearer of bad news.
So I got to bake my fries?
You can't bake them. In fact, you can actually buy baked potato chips. You know, it's the frying process more than anything else. So be aware of that, because they've been known to be a neurotoxin in high levels. This has been documented in a really respected journal called the Journal of Environmental Health Perspectives, and it is a carcinogen.
We got one more minute, Biagio. What do you want to leave the people with?
Okay, here are some examples of safer alternatives or non-toxic alternatives. And all-purpose cleaner, okay, very simple, okay, that we can use in our home, and it's a fraction of the price. 4 tablespoons of baking soda to 1 quart of warm water, you have a really good kitchen and bathroom cleaner, okay? and it's non-toxic. Drain cleaners are very toxic. It contains acids that's detrimental to the environment. So you can trap the food and hair, okay, with food traps, particle and hair remover. You can collect the grease in cans and this kind of thing. You can pour hot boiling water down the drain to melt that. And furniture polish, 2 parts of olive oil to a soft, and 1 part of lemon juice does the job. And a really good source of information on this would be nontoxicalternatives.com. And the other one would be Household Hazardous Products from the University of Missouri Extension Division, which is where I got trained at.
All right. Well, we'll put those links up on our Eco Radio KC Facebook page. And now, to finish out the show, I'm just going to give you a couple events, environmental events that are going on in our area. Saturday, March 5th at 6:30 p.m., Bridging the Gap hosts Taking Flight. Please join them for a buzzworthy evening to celebrate pollinators, listen to lively music, sip on Bee's Knees specialty cocktails, taste delicious pollinator-inspired food, and learn how Bridging the Gap will be helping butterflies and bees thrive over the next several years. It's a cocktail attire, buffet dinner, 50-50 raffle, and silent auction. And you can find more information about this event by visiting our Facebook page. We have the link up for the event there. And the Kansas City Environmental Education Network, Science Pioneers, and the Greater Kansas City Writing Project are hosting a Teaching Environmental Literacy mini-conference for teachers. This event will provide educators with strategies, projects, and lessons to integrate environmental literacy in with the STEM covered in the classroom. And this is on January 30th from 8 a.m. to 12:45 p.m. And again, more information can be found on our Eco Radio KC Facebook page. That's all I have for the events.
New outbreak of old virus alarms scientists. That and other stories for the week ending January 24th, 2016.
I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin. And it's This Week in Water.
Scientists are sounding the alarms over the spread of a mosquito-borne virus called Zika. While some who are infected may suffer mild symptoms such as a fever and rash, much more severe problems can occur.
The virus has been linked to serious birth defects, and doctors in Brazil, where up to 1 million people may be infected, now say it could be causing a rare syndrome that can leave victims almost completely paralyzed for weeks.
The disease is spreading in South America, Central America, and the Caribbean. And recently there have been cases diagnosed in New York, Illinois, and Florida.
The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is warning pregnant women to postpone travel to areas where they could be at risk of exposure.
Scientists are trying to determine if there's a link between the virus and global warming. The species of mosquito that spreads Zika thrives in warm and wet climates, and rising temperatures could lead to the insects multiplying and spreading to areas where they typically have not been before.
Currently, there is no vaccine against the Zika virus, and the only protection is to prevent mosquito bites in the first place. There were significant developments last week about the water crisis in Flint, Michigan.
The regional director of the Environmental Protection Agency resigned amid reports that her office knew about the lead poisoning in April last year, but did not alert the public.
A spokesman for the agency admitted that it didn't act as fast as it should have.
It's also been learned that an EPA water expert, Miguel Del Toro, noticed possible problems with Flint's drinking water in February last year, which he later verified. He then wrote an internal memo in June, but EPA still did not sound any alarms.
Michigan Radio reports that Del Toro was first alerted to Flint's water problems by a homeowner, Leanne Walters, who called to warn the agency about her child being diagnosed with lead poisoning.
Walters told the EPA official that Flint did not have a program to prevent pipe corrosion that caused the lead to contaminate the water. The state of Michigan, however, had told the EPA that it did.
It was announced last week that another federal agency, Health and Human Services, will investigate the government's response to the disaster.
Snowzilla. The massive blizzard that hit the U.S. East Coast has moved on, but not before affecting nearly 80 million people, causing deaths and shutdowns in 10 states.
Jonas, the official name of the storm, hit Friday through early Sunday, leaving record amounts of snowfall.
Nearly 30 inches fell in New York, Baltimore, and Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, more than have ever been recorded. A town in West Virginia had the most, 40 inches.
Coastal flooding in parts of New Jersey was worse than during Superstorm Sandy. High tides sent chunks of ice flowing down roads.
Joe Rahm, a writer with Think Progress, suggested that naming the storm Jonas wasn't quite accurate, and he proposed instead calling it Edward Snowden, because it turned Washington upside down, brought the government to a standstill, and then fled the country.
Shrinking ice in the Arctic is opening travel between the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans. But research vessels and icebreakers aren't the only ones making the journey. Birds and marine species are moving between waters too, with unknown consequences.
Seabird McKeon, a marine biologist with the Smithsonian, told CBS News that thick sea ice usually blocks migration because animals need access to the ocean's surface to breathe, and diving birds need open waters to feed.
But a decline in sea ice is allowing species to roam to new waters, and the resulting impacts are yet to be understood. While some species might be able to establish themselves in new environments without disrupting ecosystems, there could be cases where newcomers will compete for food or other resources.
For example, gray whales, normally found only in the Pacific, have been spotted off the coast of Namibia in southern Africa and even near Israel.
According to Elizabeth Alter from the City University of New York, these migrations could affect ecosystems because gray whales are ocean engineers. They scoop up mouthfuls of mud and act like bulldozers, moving around nutrients so other marine creatures and seabirds can use them.
Speaking of things moving around our seas, in other marine news, we've all heard about the whirling garbage patches, but according to a new study, by 2050, there will be more plastic than fish in the world's oceans.
A report by the Ellen MacArthur Foundation found that every year, at least 8 million tons of plastic leak into the sea, which is equivalent to dumping the contents of one garbage truck into the ocean every minute.
Ellen MacArthur, who broke the record for the fastest solo circumnavigation of the globe in 2005, says that a moonshot approach is needed where we replace plastics overall by creating ones that biodegrade or are recycled more easily.
And finally, lots of serious science is happening at the International Space Station.
Take astronaut Scott Kelly, who's spending a year in space to help gauge the effects of weightlessness on the human body in order to understand the feasibility of sending humans to Mars.
Kelly has broken the American record for the longest consecutive days in space, and he's done a lot of cutting-edge research on zero gravity. He's cultivated and eaten space lettuce and grown flowering plants. Important achievements for life on another planet.
But before he returns to Earth this spring, he had another item on his to-do list, play ping pong.
Play ping pong with a water bubble, to be more precise.
In a YouTube video, Kelly gently and slowly tosses a sphere of water between two paddles coated with Teflon.
While water on Earth is pulled down by gravity and spreads out to fill whatever container it's in, water in space floats in the shape of a ball.
Hey, if you're gonna be headed to Mars, we're guessing the in-flight magazine will only take you so far, and Netflix might be iffy.
So water ping pong? That'll be a ball. This Week in Water is sponsored by the American Water Works Association. Sustainable water management means more than just conservation. Learn more at awwa.org/sustainable16.
Thanks for listening to Eco Radio KC on 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.